oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Well, good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket today. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 090079, Dr. Thoda and North Texas Cardiology Center versus Margaret Young individually and as representative of the estate of William R. Young from Wichita County and the Second Court of Appeals District. Docket number 100960, NRAE XL Specialty Insurance Company and Cambridge Interested Integrated Services Group, Inc., which is an original proceeding from Dallas County. And 100970, Nicholas Traxler versus Entergy Gulf States, Inc., from Orange County and the Ninth Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. The arguments are being recorded, and there will be a link to the arguments posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in the first cause, 090079, Thoda versus Young.
May it please the court, Ms. Faust will present oral argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. The first issue I'd like to address this morning for the court is the question of whether the failure to follow doctor's orders during recovery, post-surgical recovery, thereby aggravating or in creating a new injury, constitutes contributory negligence. Here, the trial court found it was, the jury found it was, but the Court of Appeals disagreed, and relying on precedent from this court, indicated and held that it was actually mitigation of damages and reversed the case. Now, the Court of Appeals relied on, as I said, pre-1995 precedent from this court, Elbar versus Smith and Kirby versus Abilene Christian College. These cases, for example, like Kirby, were decided concerning mitigation in pre-1995 when, before the legislature changed Chapter 33 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Now here, the jury was asked a question of whether the negligence of the parties, that is, Dr. Thoda, the defendant, and Mr. Young, the plaintiff, proximately caused the injury in question. That question was proper under Chapter 33, Section 33003A, which provides that the trier of fact shall determine the percentage of responsibility with respect to each person.
Ms. Faust, tell me how Mr. Young's conduct caused the injury here.
Mr. Young's conduct, Your Honor, caused the injury, which was the extensive retroperitoneal bleeding that occurred. The evidence
that you're saying
that the court
bleeding was the injury and not the arterial tear itself.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So when somebody gets shot, the injury is the bleeding and not the gunshot wound.
The wound can be the injury, but the gunshot, the wound and the subsequent treatment and all the delay, yes, that's the injury. But we have the analysis that requires, we have to consider occurrence causing injury, we have to consider the injury itself. Now here, the question is, what was the evidence that supported submission of contributory negligence?
Well, let me just follow up on that a little bit. It seems that to separate the two, that is, whether the injury is the puncture or whether it's the bleeding. I mean, isn't that just a matter of semantics? Isn't the reality that if it were not for the puncture, the bleeding would have never occurred? And so how can you separate those and say that those are two distinct occurrences? Isn't that just one ball of wax?
Well, Your Honor, here we have evidence that was conflicting as to whether there was a breach of the standard of care that caused that bleeding. Here we have a puncture that is determined even by the respondent's own experts to have been, that they had full hemostasis at the time of discharge. We had conflicting evidence that the jury heard and from which the jury could infer that Dr. Thota did not negligently perform the catheterization, that he did not negligently perform that puncture in the wrong location.
Well, I understand that, but that is a different issue, I believe, than what we're getting at, isn't it?
I'm sorry. I may have misunderstood the court's
question. Well, I'm just trying to understand how the two can be distinct. In other words, the argument that the injury was the bleeding and the injury was not the puncture. And how do you separate the two?
Well, I think how we separate it under this evidence, Your Honor, is that at the time of discharge, there is no injury. There is full hemostasis. The patient goes home. The experts agreed. There is a 99% chance that there was no bleeding at all at the time he went home. The bleeding, under the expert testimony here, is that the bleeding didn't start until 6 p.m. When the plaintiff suffered extreme pain. And that could have been caused, under the evidence, by either that blood clot that had formed at the puncture site coming loose, or by a tear. That the evidence was disputed on that issue. That blood clot coming loose would not have necessarily been with the result of Dr. Thota's negligence, and the jury heard conflicting evidence about that. So in this case, at 6 o'clock, when Mr. Young does not follow his doctor's orders to return to the hospital with that pain, to return to the hospital with the what he was experiencing at that time, that gives rise to this injury, and that is this extensive bleeding and the subsequent care and treatment that he had to undergo.
You have, as you say, the evidence related to one injury or the other, whether it was a puncture, whether it was a bleeding. I'm having a hard time understanding why it makes a difference here, because whatever it was, the jury heard all of this. One side is pointing to one injury, one is pointing to the other, and they said there was, whatever the injury might have been, the doctor got a no negligence finding. So why doesn't that settle it?
Your Honor, we believe that it should settle it, but we still have, under the Court of Appeals analysis, to look at the no answer with respect to Dr. Thota in the context of whether the submission of the new and independent cause instruction was proper.
Well, and unless there's a Castile issue here, and there's some question about that, you go to a traditional harm analysis.
That is correct. And under the traditional harm analysis, then the court would have, as the dissent pointed out, looked at the entire record. The jury could have, under these conflicting facts that we've talked about, the jury could have reasonably inferred that Dr. Thota did not breach the standard of care. They don't even get to causation at that point. And
the Court of Appeals did not determine harm based on looking at the entire record, though,
as I recall, Your Honor.
Its opinion.
That's right.
The presumed harm of Castile.
That is correct. And we believe that's error, and we agree with the dissent's analysis, and that is because we can't have Castile commingling here under this circumstance, where we have two separate answers, one with respect to Dr. Thota and one with respect to Mr. Young, and those two separate theories of liability that are submitted. So you don't have the commingling issue that arises with Castile, where you have a valid theory and an invalid theory not supported by legally sufficient evidence with one answer blank. Here we know what the jury decided with respect to each one of those theories.
Do you believe that the Castile question was preserved at the trial court level?
Your Honor, we've argued that it has not been preserved. I think that if giving it a very, very liberal interpretation as the Court of Appeals did, perhaps, but we think that it required more. We think that at least the trial court should have been on notice of a problem with respect to the commingling issues that arise by submitting an invalid legal theory. And the trial court at that point should have the opportunity to correct it and at least address that issue. That never occurred here. The objection was made that the submission of contributory negligence was incorrect, that Mr. Young should not be submitted because there was no evidence of contributory negligence.
And if it was...
Because of the differing legal theories.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems to me if contributory negligence is incorrectly submitted, then you just ignore it, wouldn't you?
You would ignore it, Your Honor, under the traditional analysis, because once you look at the no answer with respect to Dr. Thoda, even the yes answer coming back with respect to Dr. Young won't alter the outcome. And so it doesn't matter what the jury says with respect to Mr. Young. We know.
But if it was incorrectly submitted, it should not have been submitted. Is there not some confusion then that the jury could have been confused? And we would move to a presumed harm analysis. Because how do we know that the jury was not confused and misled by the incorrect submission?
The incorrect submission of contributory negligence?
Yes.
Well, under Castile, we wouldn't have that commingling problem because, again, we have the ability to look at, if you're just looking at the contributory negligence of Mr. Young and Dr. Thoda, you've got separate blanks. You don't have one blank, so you have no idea what the jury determined. You know that the jury determined and failed to find that Dr. Thoda's negligence approximately caused the injury here. And that's all we need to know. We have the ability, and that's what's important under Castile. Does the court have the ability to know how the jury answered the question? Here we do, because we have two blanks.
If the torn artery was the injury, was the new, if assume that we hold that, is the new and independent cause instruction proper or not?
Your Honor, we believe it was proper because it was raised by the pleading and it was raised by the evidence. Here, the evidence is the failure of Mrs. Young to essentially follow those discharge instructions. Now, the Court of Appeals held that Mrs. Young could not be submitted as the theory under new and independent cause because she's a party. She's a party plaintiff. But you have an issue in this context where we cannot submit this party plaintiff on her derivative claim because we have other Texas law determining that she owes no duty to her husband under these circumstances. And without a duty, no contributory negligence question could be submitted with regard to her conduct.
But new and independent cause talks about causation and destroying the causal causation. But if the tear was the injury, why wouldn't her delay in getting him to the hospital not be the proper submission for a new and independent cause? And go rather to mitigation of damages.
Your Honor, if the tear is the injury, then I believe that analysis, which is the conclusion of the Court of Appeals, may be correct. We disagree with it. We don't believe that is the injury here. Then the jury here wasn't asked about what was the accident, what was the occurrence. The occurrence here is the tear, because we know that when Mr. Young went home at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he had full hemostasis there at that puncture site. We don't know whether, again, it's a clot that formed and came loose, or that the clot had come loose, or whether it's a tear as a result of negligence. There's conflicting evidence.
With respect to harm, the respondents argued, page 16 of their brief, that it's likely because of the instruction and the question, and I'm quoting, that the jury believed they could find petitioners negligent only if the jury found them responsible for the entire cascade of events stemming from the tear in the external iliac artery. That was certainly the import of the rest of the question and instructions given. What's your response to that?
Well, the jury is presumed to follow the instructions, and the new and independent cause instruction only went to causation with respect to Dr. Thoda. So in answering the question about Mr. Young's negligence, the jury would not be considering the issue of new and independent cause under those circumstances.
Well, but the argument is that the jury may have thought that they could only find Dr. Thoda negligent if they thought he was responsible for everything else that happened, after the tear, the bleeding, and then all of the problems that he had after that before he died. So what's the response,
Your Honor, to that? Really, that assumption is not borne out by the record here. We don't have, for example, we don't have any argument in closing even referring to that instruction, new and independent cause. We don't know whether the jury considered it at all. And that is just an improper assumption, I think, that the respondent has to make here. In this case, Your Honors, we believe that the contributory negligence submission was proper. And even if it was not proper, it did not constitute presumed harm requiring reversal of the case. Additionally, we believe that, and we would urge that the new and independent cause instruction was proper under the circumstances where the contributory negligence of the spouse could not be submitted where she owed no legal duty. But the evidence borne out if the injury was the bleed. The evidence did support the submission of that instruction. So therefore, there would be no error in the submission of the instruction. There would be no presumed harm, as this court has stated in the Urista case, when you have a proper liability issue with an improper inferential rebuttal defense, there is no presumed harm. You must conduct a traditional harm analysis. And under that traditional harm analysis, this court should conclude that there was no reversible error based on the arguments that we've previously asserted. If the court has no further questions,
any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Faust. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Perrin will present argument for the respondent.
Please the court. Ronnie and Margaret Young filed this lawsuit years ago to get the answer to one question. And that question was, did Dr. Thota negligently cause a tear in Ronnie Young's right external iliac artery while performing a cardiac catheterization on March 4th, 2002? Here we are 9.5 years later, and we still don't have an answer to that question. There's no way the court can look at the charge that was given in this case, and this court, the Court of Appeals, any of the parties, and be able to say that the jury has answered that question yet.
Let me ask you something. If whenever the patient was at home, and let's say the situation was that blood was gushing from him, it was just, you know, would that change your argument? Would it then not go just to mitigation?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and there are a couple reasons for that. Maybe the most significant, I think, in this circumstance, which is certainly interesting, is post-catheterization, post what we allege to be the negligence, Ronnie Young spent 5 months with hospitalization, 3 months with hospitalization, another 2 months in rehab. Over the course of those 3 months, seemingly every week, every month, there's something new coming up. He's got renal failure. He's got a splenectomy. He has his gallbladder removed because it's gangrenous. He loses vision in one eye. He has blood clots. He has thrombocytosis. And all of these things are happening along the way. All of those things can't be the injury. If all of those things are the injury, I mean, logical extension of petitioner's argument is, at any point in those 3 months, in those 4 months, in those 5 months of the follow-up care, if Ron Young at any point didn't follow a doctor's instruction, take this medicine to avoid clots, and he misses one dose. If any point along the way, Margaret Young doesn't do something that a doctor told her to do, then under petitioner's argument, that would be contributory negligence. Maybe it happened 3 months down the road, and it's contributory negligence again.
What's your response to the argument that when he left the hospital, everything was okay, and that there was evidence that substantiates that?
I will certainly admit that there was conflicting evidence on that. I mean, that's why it went to a jury. We're not here asking for the court to find as a matter of law that we should win at the trial court. But there was conflicting evidence. Plaintiff's expert, the petitioners love to cite this testimony about 99%. I think if the court will look at the record, the context of that testimony was all of the objective evidence that was available at that time was that good hemostasis had been achieved. We never sued saying that the discharge was negligent. But there was also evidence from plaintiff's expert that bleeding into the retroperitoneal cavity, which is what occurred here, only occurs if the stick is too high, if it's in the external iliac artery as opposed to the femoral artery, and that it won't go to, it will go undetected for 12 to 24 hours, particularly if it's a slow leak. It's bleeding in the retro, there's a lot of room in there, the blood builds and builds and builds, and it takes a while for it to get to a point where there are actual physical signs and symptoms associated with the bleed. There are learned treatises to that effect, a learned treatise that Dr. Thode acknowledged as a learned treatise. Undisputed that wherever the bleed was, it was the site of the puncture. And so we would certainly contend that the record as a whole reflects that there were significantly disputed factors as to whether or not there was good hemostasis achieved at the time Ronnie Young was discharged.
And the jury heard all of that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And decided that Dr. Thode, or failed to find that Dr. Thode was negligent, but found that Young was?
The jury certainly answered no as to Dr. Thode and answered yes as to Mr. Young. I would suggest, Your Honor, that in fact the yes answer as to Ronnie Young is maybe more instructive than the no answer to Dr. Thode in terms of how this charge misled and confused the jury. When the injury, as we contend, is properly understood as the tear in the right external iliac artery, then there is no way that Ronnie Young could have been contributorily negligent in causing that injury. And there's literally not a shred of evidence anywhere in the record. No one testified that he did anything to cause the tear. It goes back to my earlier comment. The tear was wherever Dr. Thode made his puncture. And so the fact that the jury answered yes as to Ronnie Young, we believe is instructive to the fact that the jury, when they were answering those questions, was thinking about everything that happened, the whole cascade from the time that Ronnie Young went home through his hospitalization, and were believing that those questions were inquiring as to everything that happened, not as to the specific question that Margaret and Ronnie Young wanted an answer to: did the negligence of Dr. Thode negligently cause a tear in his right external iliac artery?
How would you suggest that the liability question be structured then? Are you suggesting going back to specific issues? You said you've never gotten the answer to the question.
Not at all.
You started out seeking 9 years ago. Do you want to, do you want to ask the jury, is the tear the injury? Is the bleeding the injury? Who caused the tear? Are you saying we should go back to that?
I certainly hope not, Your Honor. That's not my intent.
Me too.
I believe that if the contributory negligence question was simply removed from the charge, if the new and independent cause instruction is removed from the charge, and I mean, I would submit that there should have been, given how the court viewed the case and some of the evidence that came out of trial, probably should have been an instruction on mitigation of damages. My recollection is that the defendants didn't even ask for a mitigation instruction at trial, that they were married to their contributory negligence question.
If the new and independent cause instruction was error to give, but the question about Young's negligence had not been included, then do you agree that under Urista, you'd have to show harm?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would be the your harm analysis would be the same? It indicated that he had to find them, had to find the doctor liable for everything that happened.
Yes, Your Honor. I think, I mean, it's interesting because the harm analysis as we see it really does line up with what Castile was talking about, I think. I mean, whether this obviously is not on all four squares with Castile. I mean, we don't have multiple liability theories in one blank, and we acknowledge that. That said, the harm that was caused, I mean, the rationale underlying Castile and the cases that came after, and quite frankly, the cases that came before, is that this charge in particular was so confusing to the jury, so misled the jury, as indicated by their answer of yes to the negligence of Ronnie Young, that there's just no way we can possibly say on what basis they found the way they found.
But the presumption of harm is invoked only because the question of Young's negligence was included. If it had been omitted, you'd have to show harm.
Certainly, Your Honor. Under Urista, I think the court has made it clear that a merely erroneous instruction with a proper or an erroneous instruction with a proper question is not subject to the Castile presumed harm standard.
What if you'd submitted one question as to Dr. Tholta, question number one, and question number two as to Young? Would it be your position that there's still a Castile problem?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be.
Okay. Well, and let me go into the preservation. Castile says there has to be a specific objection telling the trial court, look, here's the problem with this charge. If we have these findings, no one's going to be able to appeal it. Was that objection made to the trial court in regard to this charge?
If I could, I maybe have 2 points in response to that. My first point would be, and I think it's interesting, the petitioners never really contended that we didn't properly preserve error. I mean, sort of the, you know, did we make the court aware of what the objection was? There was no real argument about that until the motion for rehearing before this court. It certainly wasn't presented to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals didn't address it. And so I think at the very least it's interesting that this preservation of error argument maybe hasn't been preserved. But in response to your question, I think it was clear in the record during the charge conference that everyone understood that the plaintiff's objection to the charge was, look, our question on Tholta's negligence is supposed to be focused on the conduct during the catheterization and the injury caused by the catheterization, which we contend is the tear in the right external iliac artery. Their contributory negligence question, their new and intermittent cause instruction, are focused on post-catheterization, what we allege to be post-negligence conduct or activity. And this is going to confuse the jury because they have one question that's supposed to be about one thing and they have another question instruction that's
confusing
about another.
The jury, I think, is different than the Castile problem where you have a question, was the defendant or the plaintiff, either one, was one party negligent in A, B, C, or D? And then answer yes or no. And then we don't know whether they found A, B, C, or D. It seems that whether the jury's confused is different than that Castile problem where we can't tell what the jury's answer really was. And that's what I'm wondering. And did you tell the Court of Appeals that we can't tell from this charge what the jury found?
Certainly. I think without question we told the Court of Appeals. Now, admittedly, in the dissent in the opinion from the Fourth Court of Appeals pointed this out, we didn't specifically cite Castile in our briefing to the Court of Appeals, but we told the Court of Appeals.
Did either party cite Castile in the Court of Appeals? Because it seems, or the trial court, it seems like, did anybody mention that to the trial court? Because it seems like under this charge, both parties would be in the same boat. If they found Dr. Tholta negligent and Young not negligent, Dr. Tholta is going to have to appeal also. And so I'm wondering, did either party say to the trial court judge, this is going to be a problem on appeal?
To the best of my recollection, nobody talked about Castile in the trial court.
Or in the Court of Appeals, either party, to your recollection?
To the best of my recollection, nobody talked about Castile in the Court of Appeals until after the Court of Appeals opinions, when the now petitioners filed their motion for rehearing or en banc hearing from the Fourth Court of Appeals. So probably from that point forward is when Castile itself was specifically cited and talked about.
So as I understand your argument, what you want in a new trial would be a submission that says, did the negligence of Dr. Tholta approximately cause the injury to Mr. Young?
That's
without,
correct.
Without a contributory negligence and without a new and independent cause submission at all. And then that to the extent Dr. Tholta thinks that the injuries were exacerbated by the failure to seek medical care promptly, that would be submitted in a mitigation of damages instruction.
That's our position, Your Honor. Even Kirby, which everyone has cited in hundreds of times in all the briefing, Kirby versus Abilene Christian College, you know, I mean, the direct quote from the court is, negligence that increases or contributes to the extent of an injury, I mean, they use the word injury, is not contributory negligence and mitigation of damages. And that's the situation we have here. I mean, this the negligence, if any, of Ronnie Young didn't cause the injury. It didn't cause the tear in the right external iliac artery. It contributed to the extent of them. It maybe exacerbated them. And the jury being charged on that, if the evidence came out the exact same way, I can't imagine we'd have any objection to a mitigation instruction, and we would argue it to the jury the best we could.
And what would your argument be if the jury returns a verdict of zero damages?
Then I guess the defendant would have met their burden of proving to the jury that he didn't mitigate any of his damages. I don't think that would be possible. Because even the defendant's counsel at trial, in his closing argument with the jury, said Ronnie Young should have come back to the hospital at 6 o'clock when he first felt the pain. If he'd come back at 6 o'clock, all that would have had to have been done is Dr. Walker, the vascular surgeon who ultimately repaired it, would have had to repair the tear in the right external iliac artery. So there was some damage caused, and that damage was at the very least the repair to the right external iliac artery. Obviously, we contend that the cascade is at least to some degree the responsibility of Dr. Thode and his negligence. There is some harm for sure.
A lot of attention is being placed on the term injury here, and of course some submissions, occurrence, incident, accident. Do we make too much of that distinction in terms of whether the jury is confused or not? I mean, they know what's going on, don't they?
I certainly think so, Your Honor. I've searched high and low for anything from this court that has drawn any real distinction between the use of those two words in a jury charge and have struggled to find anything. The petitioners have cited a lot to the comments from the PJC. And this is a case that I don't think it's cited anywhere. I found it yesterday when I was thinking about what we were going to talk about here today. And I would suggest to the court that Block versus Mora, the site is 314 Southwest 3rd, 440. It's a 2009 case from the Amarillo Court of Appeals. Really has a lot of similar issues to what we're talking about here. It was a car wreck case, and I don't want to spend too much time on the facts, but it was a jury charge that used the word injury. There was a contributory negligence question submitted. The Court of Appeals found that question was incorrect. Said, we don't care what the PJC says. Just because a jury charge uses the word injury doesn't mean you get a contributory negligence question. The evidence has to support it. You get contrib when the evidence supports it. And ultimately decided that it was a Castile problem because there was a valid theory of liability submitted, the negligence of the defendant. With an invalid theory of liability submitted, the alleged contributory negligence of the plaintiff, and found that Castile applied, presumed harm, and sent it back to the trial court. I think the petition was dismissed by agreement of the parties sometime in 2009. And I apologize for that not being in the briefs, but I've found it, and I think it might be helpful to the court.
Petitioners claim that Elbor versus Smith really causes you a problem with your case. Do you agree with the Court of Appeals' attempt to distinguish it, or do you have a different argument?
No, I think the Court of Appeals, the focus has to be, when you're talking about the difference between contributory negligence and mitigation, really, I think, boiled down to its core is the timing of the negligence. I mean, was the negligence concurrent with or precede the actual injury of which you're complaining, thereby contributing to or causing it, or was it post negligence? In this case, all the evidence about the standard of care dealt with where the stick was located. All the evidence about the injury was where the stick was located. And so if all we're doing is post negligence, post injury contributing to, then obviously it's mitigation as opposed to contrib. You know, I think I said it in some brief somewhere, but this case would only be like Elbar if in Elbar the doctor had actually broken the ankle doing the surgery, and then the infection happens later, and the allegation is the infection occurred because the patient didn't follow instructions in taking the antibiotics. In that case, the patient went to see Dr. Elbar specifically related to post-broken ankle. The injury complained of was the infection in the ankle. And because the patient didn't follow instructions in taking antibiotics and other things, then it was her negligence that contributed to that injury, the infection. In this case, any negligence of Ronnie Young was post-injury, post-tearing the right external iliac artery. And as such, should have, if anything, been properly charged as mitigation, not contrib. I appreciate the time. We're glad to be here, and we're proud to represent these folks, and we would just like an opportunity to have the question answered.
Thank you, Mr. Perrin. It appears no further questions, and the court will hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points. Why isn't there a mitigation instruction in the charge? According to the PJC comments at 4.1 and 8.9, when the question is submitted as injury in question, approximately cause of the injury in question, such as it was here, then contributory negligence is properly submitted by the trial court and mitigation of damages is not included in the damages question. And that's exactly what occurred here. Contrib was submitted in that form, injury in question, so there was no mitigation of damages instruction that I recall even being requested.
So do you think there is a distinction between using the term injury versus occurrence?
Yes, Your Honor. It goes back really to this change we saw in 1995, I think, to Chapter 33, because now our juries are by statute required to consider each person that submitted, the claimant or the defendant or a responsible third party, their causing or contributing to cause in any way the harm for which damages are sought, in any way. That would include aggravating or increasing the harm, even under Kirby,
I guess. My question is, do you think that that's a distinction that, that the juries recognize? By and large, or would that be lost on them?
Well, I think that the jury is going to, as the law says, follow the instructions. And that mitigation in damages instruction, I believe the jury would follow it, Your Honor, if it's properly given. It's not given here in this context when the jury is actually determining whether the defendant was contributorily negligent. So they're going to be considering the issue as whether the plaintiff is contributing to cause the actual injury itself, rather than just did the plaintiff take all precautions not to increase the damages that somebody else caused and he had no hand in.
Okay, so if you had looked at this case as, well, this is not an injury case, this is an occurrence case, you would have submitted it differently?
It should have been submitted differently as an occurrence case. You know, that there was never any question raised about defining injury in question under this charge. It wasn't defined, and the jury was told to anything that's not defined is given its common, ordinary meaning. The issue on whether or not the jury was then going to follow and give it its own meaning, injury in question. The parties were arguing, and the jury heard differing theories, and the jury made the decision on which theory to accept and which theory to reject. I haven't read that I recall the Block versus Mora case. I apologize to the court, but again, I would think in that instance where the it appears that this Court of Appeals is rejecting the comment in the pattern jury charge that you will not include the mitigation of damages instruction when you use the injury question, or you won't put the contributory negligence in an injury question. I think then really the resolution has to be, it's very important for this court to look at how Chapter 33 operates here. And if the PJC is wrong, then this court should take care of that problem and either announce that Block versus Moore has been decided correctly, or that under Chapter 33, We're going to submit that plaintiff for the harm, so long as the jury is going to decide whether that person caused or contributed to cause in any way, including aggravating or exacerbating those injuries that someone else may have caused that occurred later. With that, Your Honors, we would ask that the court reverse.
Before you sit down, let me ask you a question. In the dissenting opinion on the Court of Appeals, Justice Gardner says that she disagrees with the majority's sua sponte application of the presumed harm analysis adopted in Crown Life. Opposing counsel said Castile, to his recollection, was not mentioned to the trial court by either party, nor was it in the briefs in the Court of Appeals. Do you recall it being argued in the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, I did not see it argued in the charge conference, in the trial court, in the Court of Appeals. According to the briefs, I believe that the respondents argued Walmart versus Johnson, or cited Walmart versus Johnson, which I think is what the Court of Appeals held. Citation to that case would have preserved the Castile error on presumed harm. But where the issue really became apparent was when the Court of Appeals did, on its own, apply the Castile argument of presumed harm. Then at that point in time, there was a motion for rehearing filed that, and one of the grounds was that the Court of Appeals reversed based on unassigned error because nobody had ever brought that error to the attention of the trial court. So that at that point in time, then everything had been raised and brought forward on the issue of whether or not, as the dissent pointed out, it was raised sua sponte by the Court of Appeals majority.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.